You know, when something like this happens, you don't think, oh, it's my neighbor across the street or my son's friend in high school. No, it's always somebody else or somewhere else. Well, here it is. I mean, you know, he came from Boone County. He went to a good school, lived in a good neighborhood.
Derek Weimer, one of James Alex Fields' high school teachers. Neighbors call Fields shy, a gentle giant. Police call him a murder suspect after deadly violence in Charlottesville. This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to discuss hate groups in Ohio, plus this week's other top stories, are Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher, Local 12 News investigative reporter Dwayne Pullman, and WCPO.com reporter Amanda Seitz. You can join us 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Amanda, James, and Dwayne, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with talking about 20-year-old James Fields. He's from Maumee, Ohio, which is near Toledo. But before he lived up there, he lived in Boone County.
He's actually born in Boone County. He is a Boone County native. I mean, you say he's from Maumee. He's really from Boone County.
Right.
I mean, he lived there his whole life until 2 years ago.
Right. He's only been up there for what?
2 years.
2 years.
Two years. He actually entered the Army, enlisted in the Army, but then within 5 months he was out.
And, why? Do we know why?
There is some reporting that says he was not qualified for duty. But we haven't been able to verify that. It's not been clear as to why he left, but, you know, we do know that he was there for 5 months. I don't know if he completely finished basic training. He left, I think, before basic training was over.
Yeah. The Army is not commenting at this point.
Right.
So we don't really know for sure what happened.
Right.
With
right.
That.
Yeah. Right. And I've seen some reporting saying that he wasn't fit for duty, but like I said, and like Dwayne said, we've not been able to verify that. So we have no idea, but it's, you know, for somebody not to finish basic at least is unusual for somebody to, and I think the washout rate is less than 10% or
right.
something.
It's like usually that. Stuff after basic.
Right. So, and like he lived and he actually has quite a tragic background. His grandfather, was involved in a murder suicide with his grandmother while his mother was still alive. Well, obviously his mother was alive when his mother was like 16 or 19, I think. His grandfather shot his mother and then shot himself, shot his grandmother and then shot himself. His mother, we don't know why, but his mother is a paraplegic in a wheelchair, and his father was killed in an auto wreck, shortly before he was born. The man was drunk who was driving the car. Fields' father was in the car, was injured, and then the guys went back to the bar, and one of the guys who drove him back, the guy who he hit, drove him back to the bar, and they just sat there, and they didn't realize, I mean, they knew, but the other driver didn't realize that Fields' father was in the car. So there's a lot of that background going on.
A lot of tragedy here.
Right. And then his mom got transferred up to Maumee for her job. We're not clear exactly what she does, but she got transferred up, you know, 2 years ago for her job, and James moved with her.
The neighbors say that the mother was in an accident as well. We haven't been able to confirm it.
Right.
That left her paralyzed.
Yeah.
And the mother switched to the job. The neighbors say that the son, James Fields Jr., went there first.
Oh, okay.
So
the other thing that's come out in the last couple of weeks too is that the mother had called local police, both Florence Police and Boone County Police, several times, saying her son was violent, her son was threatening her, she didn't feel like she could control him. There has been some reporting that he was on some kind of medication. We're not, you know, and I've been told that, but we haven't published it. So that's all hearsay as well.
Yeah. Do we know James or Dwayne what influenced him, how he fell into this white supremacy ideology?
Well, and that's very clear from the teacher that he had white supremacy beliefs. He talked vocally, according to the teacher and verified by others at the school, talked vocally about his love of Hitler, about the supremacy of the white race. And this was when he was a freshman.
Yeah.
he was talking vocally.
Some of his classmates have said they've known him since middle school, and he was drawing swastikas and wearing swastikas on his clothing as early as middle school. And that during a school trip abroad, he was making uncomfortable comments while they were actually touring Dachau, the concentration camps and things like that. So,
And referring to Germany as the fatherland.
Yes.
Yeah, that's something I found interesting was that it seemed like a lot of people echoed the same exact sentiments about how he behaved in high school.
Yeah, yeah. And I actually talked to the principal there at Cooper. It's like 2 miles from my house. And he said, you know, he wouldn't comment on whether they knew officially, you know. Now, the teacher, Mr. Weimer, who you quoted, who you played his clip from, he told me that in freshman year, James had submitted a paper that had these beliefs clearly on it, and that the teacher who got the paper did file a report. Now, whether that – we've not been able to verify that. We're not going to get those records because of privacy concerns. But
that's the point of this is that everyone kind of said – now, the teacher we're talking about, Weimer, could speak more freely because he's done. He's not a teacher anymore there.
Right.
And it was remarkable, the picture he painted.
Right.
But everyone was concerned. The question is, with the radical beliefs, what could they have done? And they're asking that question. What more could have been done?
Well, and that's – and in a general sense, I talked to the principal at Cooper, and he said, well, you know, there's only – so there is freedom of speech here. There's freedom of speech issues and freedom of thought issues. If he's not being violent, he's not being offensive, although there's a question of whether or not he was wearing swastikas to school. And he said, you know, if there was somebody with a Confederate flag sticking out of their pickup truck, we could make him take it down. So – we've gotten reports that he would wear swastika clothing to school. So whether was he ever taking it off? But he was never violent. He never confronted anybody about his beliefs. You know, he never acted out, according to the classmates. So, again, it creates quite a dilemma for educators in terms of how far can you go to change somebody's mind.
Well,
you can try, but if you don't succeed, what do you do?
Weimer had an interesting quote, and I used it. He said he, being James, was not a behavior problem. He was not a discipline problem. He was respectful and fairly quiet. But he was uttering these radical beliefs.
Right.
It seemed like one of those things that people just felt like he may be a little off or odd, but not enough to go forward and report someone over.
Well, and one of his classmates actually told the Inquirer that I felt he was all bluster. I felt that it was all bark and no bite. And, you know, a lot of kids go through this stage or whatever. So, you know, we're never going to get at, unless somebody gives it to us, we're never going to get at officially from Boone County Schools exactly how many times he was reported, what his discipline was or whatever, because he was a minor and that's all protected under FERPA.
But there's a key point, and I know you want to talk about it. There's a key point that he was not at that high school the whole time.
Right.
There's a 2 year or so absence in the middle. He was there from freshman year and he was there for senior year. Yeah. In between, there's a reference to some trouble, but we're not getting confirmation what that trouble was.
We don't know if he was homeschooled or if he went somewhere else or whatever. And apart from those reports, we've not been able to discern whether he was ever, you know, accused of any crimes or if he had a criminal record or anything like that. We've certainly run through that.
Right. Juvenile, if it was there, could be hidden, but we have no confirmation is the key.
Right. Dwayne, was he part of the Unite the Right group that organized that rally at
You're raising the questions we're all trying to answer. How did he become radicalized? I think that's what we're trying to get to. And we really don't know because, literally speaking, he kept to himself. The interesting thing that the neighbor – who talked to everybody, I think, told me, Eric Schuster, is he knew the mom so well, talked so much about they would hang out together, yet he did not know this kid.
Right.
He said he would say hello, but not much beyond that.
Yeah.
So here you have a kid who lost his father and his mother was paralyzed outside of the reports of violence in the home and threats. You can assume in that kind of pattern he kept to himself and in this day and age spent a lot of time at his computer, I would assume.
Right. And, you know, I talked to some of the other neighbors and they always said he was well-mannered, quiet, rode his bike, took the bus. And, you know, one lady even said, you know, I used to clean houses. She would help, he would help me with my buckets across the street. But of course, that normalizes him, you know.
Well,
but
even his mom was saying she was unaware that he was going to this rally in Charlottesville.
Well, she said he knew he was going to a rally, but she said she thought it was a Trump rally and it was for Trump. She says she didn't realize that it was for this alt-right, Unite the Right movement or whatever. And that's what she said publicly. She's since clammed up and not been accessible. But, you know, again, and she did say she didn't know he had these kinds of beliefs until they showed his picture clearly and at the front lines of one of these rallies in Charlottesville. But, you know, again, you know, normal procedure when he turns in a paper like that in freshman year is to notify the parent. So there's, you know.
There is no way that mom didn't know about some of the tendencies, given the dress and all of that stuff. She didn't talk about that directly. But you're talking about how did he become this way? Who knew? And what was it about him that didn't represent a direct threat?
And I think it raises a bigger question, too, about, OK, you know, this guy or a student in your school is clearly has these beliefs. And it wasn't just, oh, I fell in love with the Nazis because they were really good at war and World War II. This was researched. Intellectually thought out arguments that he would have with his teachers. So he was doing the research and he had bought in fully. So what do you do with that? What do you do with that? Other than to argue you're wrong, you can't make him change his mind and you can't punish him for it. So it represents a really big dilemma for educators across the country.
It keeps raising the question in my mind, how was he radicalized?
I think we're in a day and age where just like everything else, the flow of information has opened up all kinds of possibilities for the extremists.
Well, look at the Green Township jihadi. He was radicalized probably in much the same way, over the internet, recruited, whatever. And next thing you know, he's plotting to blow up the White House. So, you know, it either ends of the spectrum, there's this extreme violence that is targeting young people. And it's a lot easier than it used to be.
Well, I think that it bridges into the other character who's tied to our area. This Matthew Heimbach, mm-hmm. who we focused on. Matthew Heimbach came from a highly educated environment. He's a college grad from Maryland who moved to Cincinnati, who is absolutely intelligent, well-spoken, and filled with the kind of hate and propaganda that I've seen for three decades from many others. He has an opinion that is based on an intellectual argument about white supremacy. Doesn't mean it's right. It's just well-researched. And we're seeing a lot more of that.
Was he in Charlottesville?
Yes. Matthew Heimbach, who has demonstrated on the streets of Cincinnati, was in Charlottesville. He was also on national media 2 days in a row, spewing about how the left caused the violence.
And then the other regional tie, which has been in the news lately, is the Daily Stormer, which is basically the internet's outlet for, you know, one of the main websites for this kind of thinking. And they've basically been shut down. Yeah. You know, GoDaddy revoked their license or their URL or hosting. Google won't host them. And like you said earlier, the Russians won't even host them anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, even a day after, they were spewing an unbelievably offensive piece about the woman who died. And it just, you know, it's not just everybody thinks about Nazism or even the KKK as being in the South. It's not just the South. It's here. It's in Ohio. It's in Kentucky.
The KKK started in Indiana. People forget that. The other part is the gentleman who started the Daily Stormer, which is based on Der Stormer, the mouthpiece of the Nazi propaganda that led to what we had in World War II. The Daily Stormer was started by Andrew Anglin. Andrew Anglin grew up in Dublin, Ohio, in a rich suburb of Columbus. Right. And he has a thing at his disposal called the Troll Army. And if you do any research about this, the Troll Army takes the internet and they absolutely swarm on anyone who has any criticism. And I had the unfortunate fortunate ability to go knock on the door where he grew up and where his mom lived. Based on that, they were trying to shut down our website at the station where I was, and I was the subject of endless
criticism. They came after you.
Oh, they came after me hard. And he claimed that I was a Jew terrorist who was harassing his mother. If you look up to this day at Google and you look at my image, there's an old star that they used to give to the Jews who were being sent to the concentration camp on my lapel. These are the guys that do that.
Yeah, that's one of the hazards when you do in-depth reporting on groups.
Well, I don't even think it's in-depth.
They've been attacking on Twitter and Facebook. They've been attacking well-known people, Jewish people. And it's gotten to the point where those people have to put parentheses around their names so they can't be it's harder to identify them or tag them online. So it's – the stuff has gotten worse in a lot.
Well, let me give you – and the other part is it doesn't matter. I'm not Jewish.
Right.
But when I pointed out I'm not Jewish and you're trying to put me into a category and excuse it because you think I'm that, they went back and researched my family history all the way back to the Middle Ages and said, well, your family was Jewish and you had to convert in 14. That's how crazy it got.
Dwayne, Matthew Heinbach, he's got this group called the Traditionalist Worker Party?
Worker Party.
There's also the Traditionalist Youth Network.
Correct. That's the outreach arm that they were reaching
out
to.
How much recruiting are groups like this doing to young people?
They're doing a lot of recruiting, but quite frankly, they're recruiting in ways on the internet that's much more effective. He has probably, around 500 members, but he speaks to millions through the Daily Stormer and like-minded, and a lot of it's centered on the frustration of the youth today. And a lot of this, quite frankly, is rooted in economic disadvantage situations. It's appealing to young people, my opinion, based on what I've seen. It's appealing to young people who have a lot of time on their hands and can't get the jobs.
How right. How big of a threat have you guys gauged that this is in Ohio specifically, in
our
region?
Well, I did a little bit of research, and there was a news outlet, Reveal, that did a review of 201 either were considered hate crimes or terrorist plots in the last between 2008 and 2016. There were 201 incidents in the database, and 2 to 1 were right wing versus Islamic. And for example, in Ohio, in northern Ohio alone, there were 5 different incidents in that 8-year span that were right wing versus 1 left wing and 2 Islamic. So, you know, it's definitely out there.
Southern Poverty Law Center lists more than 900 hate groups. The vast majority, and they've been criticized for how they determine that, but take it at what it is. They track the hate groups, 900 some. In the tri-state, Indiana, Kentucky, and Ohio, you have 84.
Yeah.
The vast number of those are white supremacist leanings or some root in that endeavor.
And their tracking method's pretty interesting too, because they, like, if there's a flyer even circulating within the region.
It's interesting because now all of a sudden the some of these groups have fought back and called the Southern Poverty Law Center an alt-left hate group. So, you know, it's battling for people's minds with semantics a lot of times.
Well, what is interesting is the examination right now. Why do we have this? What has it been here the whole time? Is it becoming more militant? I think there's definitely a sense in talking to the leaders who will talk to me that they're emboldened. They're definitely feeling that now is the time to strike.
And has Charlottesville just emboldened even more?
Yes. I asked Heinbach that in a Skype interview where on the day after, a little more than a day after, I said, you know, has this emboldened you, or are you going to do what they say and settle it down? He said, I mean, it was just unbelievable to me. He made the argument that you know, it's left, et cetera, et cetera. And he called Charlottesville on, after all this, a stunning victory for us.
There are rallies planned in New York and Boston this weekend, and then there's also discussion or plans for one in Lexington in a week or so. And I know, like, even Mitch McConnell has said, you're not welcome here, the mayor, who I'm sure is a target for very much a mayor of Lexington, I'm sure is a target for these guys, has talked about taking down some of the Confederate monuments. And I know they're talking about coming here to protest and rally that. So we're going to see more of these popping up.
The interesting part is the discussion to take down the monuments, by and large, took place after Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. You're hearing all of that talk now. Lexington,
that got ratcheted up, yeah, after Charlottesville.
We're talking about two monuments in Lexington. And from
Baltimore took down like three in the middle of the night because they didn't want any trouble, but they took them down.
Franklin, too, they did the same thing where with that monument, they took it down in the middle of the night.
Right.
There's also been concern, too, from Cincinnati City Council members that protests might occur here to the point that people have said, what can we do to limit permits? And
right. Which is an interesting, and my colleague Kevin Aldrich wrote about this in our opinion pages, the editorial page editor, about the free speech issues that this raises. If you start limiting free speech, you're just making their case stronger.
But to a certain extent, from the media point of view, we've taken a position of not trying to give voice to these extremist views. Right. And here's a really important part of this. While we've been... When I did the piece on Heimbach, and this is a perfect example, when I did the piece on Heimbach, there were discussions. Why give the guy a voice? And my point is, these extremist views already have voice. What we've not been doing is telling the general public what is going on out there.
Is the old saying, sunshine is the best disinfectant.
Correct.
You know, and there's that certainly argument. You know, Megyn Kelly had Jones on her show not too long ago.
Yeah, Alex Jones. InfoWars.
And tried to pin him down and there was a lot of debate over whether to give him a voice.
Exactly.
And how do you skirt the line between exposing and being fair?
You know, it's really interesting too. We tend to look at the arguments from the individuals, who are associated with the hate groups, are leaders of these quote-unquote hate groups. And it sounds perfectly normal until you drill down. And the point of fact, and I was just rereading some of what Heimbach said to me, he said, I guess I could be a racist, but we're not a hate group. And then when you drill down, his idea is one of a white separatist state. That is literally no one else but whites. And I said, well, what about the other races? What do you do with them? His point is, well, have a negotiation at the table. The African Americans can have this, or the Hispanics can have that. That is just so out there that any reasonable person would say, what are you talking about?
Well, see, you're getting to a point here that we had a caller, Judy, who said that, I think it was you, Dwayne, who was talking about how members of these groups are intelligent. And she asked the question, she'd like some clarification because she doesn't look at their views as being intelligent views.
Well, intelligence doesn't speak to heart. You can have
or necessarily
a rigorous
logic or
look,
it's Adolf Hitler was brilliant.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's horrible to even think that we have to say that, but it's true. Look, I don't want to call them crazy because I'm not an expert on what crazy is.
Right.
But you don't look at someone with a mental illness and say they aren't intelligent. You don't look at someone who has a predisposition of hate and say they aren't intelligent. It's just, what are they funneling into the worldview? And how are they framing that?
So where's your reporting go next on this, Dwayne?
I'm going to stay with Heimbach. I'm looking at the bigger picture of the things we've been discussing, which is how many are out there, how much is tied to this area, and why.
Right. And then, what are their next steps? And what else has happened in our area that we may have undercovered and not know about? So
then that's where we have that introspection in the media is, have we, because by and large, we tend to say if there's a rally or something, we don't want to draw attention to that. But should we be covering this, and where's that line?
Well, we covered quite a bit back in the late 1990s and early 2000s when the KKK would come here and put up their cross every year. And we would cover that. And that's gone out of – that's been discontinued because, you know, the city gave control of the square over to 3CDC. But back in the day, that was an annual point of conflict. And we had that conversation every year.
That was always a debate in every newsroom. How much attention do you give them?
Because they would do it on a Saturday. And some of them would come in with hoods and some of them wouldn't. And you just – whatever. Do you expose it for what it is or you just ignore it? And we wound up covering it most of the time. And actually a colleague of mine who works in Louisville now got an interview with one of them and got to follow him around for a little bit and just to really put out there what these guys really think.
Well, you know, keep in mind there's no official count, but by a lot of different experts, the Daily Stormer – reaches 2+ million people.
Right.
And so it's a different day and age on, as we know, in the media. And the fact that we don't cover, they're getting outlets.
Unfortunately, and it's always, I think it's always been this way. There is going to be a group of subset of our society that is always going to be attracted to this kind of rhetoric and this kind of movement. It's just a question of how do we, you know, negotiate around that or minimize that. I think it's always going to be a dark corner of our society. Mm-hmm. It's just how much can we push it into that corner?
Well, and to point on that, you know, I don't want to get into the politics. There is a threat from both the extreme right and left. The right is, by and large, the picture of, hey, you see that as the clear threat. And it takes me back to my days in North Carolina, where one of the leading federal experts on this, when I was researching the Klan and all of that, said, look, the left has been a threat historically, but it's always the right that we have to look at, because that's where we get some of the true violence and the guns. And that's just from law enforcement.
Well, Dwayne, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Investigative reporter for Local 12 News, Dwayne Pullman. Coming up, are taxpayers getting their money's worth from the banks? After the break, we'll continue our review of local news with Amanda Seitz and James Pilcher. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. And joining us for the weekly review of local news, Amanda Seitz with WCPO.com and James Pilcher with The Inquirer. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Amanda, you've been looking into whether taxpayers have been getting their money's worth from the banks project. Take us back a little bit and give us some background on this. What was the original promise that was made? How was this all supposed to work out when the banks was started 10 years ago?
Yeah, so it's been exactly 10 years since that agreement was signed. And it's a huge document, hundreds of pages, actually. And in that document, it says that taxpayers will spend no more than $106 million. And that includes things like the infrastructure. So the parking garages mostly are a big thing there, sidewalks, that sort of thing. Smail Riverfront Park is not included in that figure. And then in return, private development would be between $600 and $800 million. And so we wanted to take a look at where are we at, what are we missing still, what do we have, and how much does the banks look like what we thought it would 10 years ago. And we found that so far private development has been $280 million. But taxpayers have already reached what
they put their money in already.
They've definitely upped
their... And a little bit more, if I understand correctly.
Yes, yeah. They've invested $135 million over the last decade. And the project's still not complete.
Does that money, the 280, does that include what GE's already put into it, or is that separate?
Yeah, it's the whole shebang. So what we've already seen at the banks.
Okay. And the original premise was we were going to get $600 to $800 million. And that, so there's obviously still a lot of work that, that needs to be done here.
Definitely. And I mean, just even spending time walking around the banks, you can see there's the phase three, right? There's this empty parking garage that the county and city opened up last year, and there's no development there. There's supposed to be a development project there, but it's going to sit empty until a new developer comes on, because the Carter, the developer who's worked on the project for over a decade now, has exited the project that was announced last month. And now they're on the hunt for a new developer.
Yeah, well, and this is not to say that there haven't been some successes with the
banks. Oh, yes.
I mean, you've got GE Global Ops there and a number of other things. It's attracted, what, 5,000 jobs?
Yes, and GE's been a huge win. I mean, that was something when I talked to some economic development experts that they said part of the reason that the banks has struggled a little bit as far as restaurants coming in and going out is because we didn't have this kind of corporate jobs down at the banks. And so now with GE, that's a huge deal for the city. That's going to attract more companies, hopefully, to come to the banks and relocate there. And that will help those restaurants stay stable.
Has anybody in your conversations discussed what the impact of the recession was and how that might have slowed it down? You know, I know that we've had some wins lately, but there for a while it was slow because of that. And as we saw, there was restaurants coming in and out. We had all the controversy around mahoganies and all that. So I don't know if anybody had discussed what the impact of the recession was.
Yeah, and that was actually one of the biggest changes, and it happened very quickly, was the idea of condos down at the banks. That was something that was in the original master agreement. And then when everything blew up with the housing in 2008, that was very quickly nixed. It's something that the bank steering committee at their last meeting, they kind of brought up, do we want to start thinking about condos? Are we there yet in a position to do that? And it's still kind of we don't know yet. The housing market with condos, they're not sure if that's going to be something that they want.
Yeah. Is there enough of that downtown millennial kind of audience or market for that, even as GE tries to bring in the younger employees, as well as P&G has gone younger and cooler, if you will? Is there still that, you know, mass of energy that will create enough market demand for that?
Yeah. And one on the positive side about condos that I've heard a lot of people bring up is that it would create more of a community down at the banks, and there'd be more of an identity there. There would be people that kind of own and live there, like you see in places like over the Rhine, that people feel very connected to that area. And that's something that's kind of missing there as the result of, you know, obviously there's a lot of apartments down there, but people coming and going.
Now, you were able to speak with former Cincinnati City Councilman Chris Bortz, who helped oversee the agreement that launched the banks. So what's he say about this?
That was a very fascinating interview. I mean, he had a lot of strongly worded things to say. He called the project, I don't know that he necessarily used the words failure, but close to, just not what he initially had in mind for this project. And the reason we reached out to him is he was actually one of the first people to suggest moving the banks project out of control of this bank steering committee, which is overseen by a very small group of powerful people that includes Bob Castellini, the owner of the Reds, Katie Blackburn, vice president for the Bengals. So he was one of the first people to suggest that that committee no longer oversee the banks, and that the Port Authority actually oversee the banks. And that never got anywhere, actually, under him. He had introduced the motion a couple of times. So that's why we kind of reached out to him to see what he thought of what was going on down there. And
I know a lot of this has to probably point back to the developer, Carter, who I think is out of Atlanta. Did you talk to them, and what was their take on it? You know, Bortz described them as being inexperienced. Were there other developers that could have done the job better, or given the economy, was it going to happen anyway? Or, you know, what was the take you got?
One of the biggest things that I found out through my research, and I'm sure people who have been here longer than I have remember, was that initially there were two developers on the project, and one mm-hmm. of them had the capital really in this project. And when that developer, the other developer, the bigger developer dropped out, it was just Carter basically left on this project.
So Carter's exited now. They're
yes,
looking
they're
for
gone.
A new developer. What are leaders hoping for in a new developer? What are they looking for?
I think a lot of people. So part of why Carter has exited this project is that they were supposed to launch the third phase of the banks over a year ago, and they missed both deadlines. They paid in one case, they paid the county an extension fee. So that's part of why they're off. And I think a lot of people are looking for kind of a new, fresh look, kind of looking at it as an opportunity to bring someone new on who might have some new ideas. Even when I spoke with Tom Gableman, who is the lead attorney on this project, he said that he's even open to different ideas for the banks project that weren't included in the master plan. So I think they're really looking at this as a fresh set of eyes.
What's being planned for the third phase, Amanda? What is that?
Well, that's to be determined. I know some of the priorities that when I talked to city and county leaders that they've discussed is getting an entertainment venue figured out if they want that or they don't want that down at the banks. Also, they'd love to see another big corporation like GE or headquarters down there, too, to bring those jobs, to bring more bodies at the banks, especially during the daytime hours and just in general.
And at this point, do we know, is there any idea of when a new developer is going to be in place?
So Tom Gableman, again, he's the lead attorney on the banks. He told me 90 days would be pretty hopeful as far as getting someone selected. So maybe by the end of this year, but I think it sounded like that would be a really quick process if that were to happen.
Hey, you also did some reporting on the senior services levy. What's the story there?
Yeah, so the county has three levies that are up for consideration this fall. And they go through a months-long process where they figure out what works for each levy, what doesn't. And the three levies that they're looking at right now are mental health, senior services, and the indigent care levy. And we found with the senior services levy that they're going to go ahead and put an increased levy on the ballot. It's been approved. It's ready to go for voters to look at and decide on. And in one of those, kind of tucked away in that increase was this plan to add some new services to the senior services levy. And that would include homeless respite care, a health university initiative, and then a visiting nurses association, too, would also benefit. And we're looking at $1 million extra each year for those programs. That's what County Commission President Todd Portune told me he would like to see. And
do we know how big of an increase we're talking about with the levy, Amanda?
So it would be about $5 million total.
But one thing that Amanda pointed out, too, though, that would be controversial is that it would funnel some money to this organization called Closing the Health Gap, which both WCPO and the Inquirer has investigated and shown some of the questionable spending and lack of financial control, even though they are receiving public money. And that's actually created a huge political backlash and backlash against both of our outlets, plus against others in city council by former Mayor Dwight Tillery, who runs this thing. So that's going to be another controversial hot point.
Yeah. And I think a big question, too, was that the county spends months reviewing what should go in these levies. And they hire outside consultants. They spend thousands of dollars on that. And these three particular programs were not looked at for the senior services levy. They were looked at for the indigent care levy. But to fund those programs, the county commissioners would have had to have agreed to an increase in the indigent care levy as well. So it raises the question of, are these programs needed, one, for the county's seniors, and are they appropriate for this levy as well?
Yeah. And the levy is going to be on this November's ballot?
This November, yeah. And it will cost the homeowner of a $100,000 home $10.59 extra a year. Mm-hmm. So it's not a huge increase, but there's question as to how these programs fit into this levy.
Yeah. James, what's the news on the Brent Spence Bridge?
What would a show with me be without me talking about the Brent Spence Bridge?
Exactly.
Hallelujah. We're seeing the beginning of the end of
really?
The construction.
I'll believe it when I see it.
I know. But this weekend, they're supposed to start opening up the top, all four lanes of southbound on the top deck of southbound 75 and 71 are supposed to be open by Monday morning at 5 a.m. And that includes opening some of the ramps that were to those, along those lines. They even closed ramps in Erlanger because they had to deal with all the traffic from 275 funneling. So I'm hoping that the 3rd Street ramp on the 7175 South will be open. And then over the course of the week, they're still going to have it down to two lanes on the northbound lanes, which is the bottom deck. But over the course of the week, by Friday, they're supposed to have all those open up the four lanes. Now, it is going to create some pain over the weekend because they're going to be
down to
one lane.
Yeah, there's something starting at 9 o'clock. Yeah,
they're going to be down to one lane.
Yeah.
So avoid the bridge this weekend at all costs if you can. But starting Monday, it's really going to clear
up. On eclipse day, it'll be.
And if anybody lives – yeah, exactly. If anybody lives in northern Kentucky – can tell you or has to drive that it, between the states can tell you it is completely fouled traffic in all the state systems. 471 has gotten a ton more traffic. They've routed all of I-71 south on I-70 on 471, which pushes it all the way on around 275 through Taylor Mill and all and past the AA highway. It's just the system has been taxed to its extreme. And so hopefully we'll start seeing some, you know, you try to cross on the west side of downtown, the Clayway Bailey Bridge, about 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock is jammed. As an alternate, as well as the suspension bridge has been jammed. So hopefully we'll start seeing some relief next week.
Even when I leave this show to go on Central Parkway at 2 o'clock on Fridays to get back to WCPO, it's a mess because of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, the one thing I want to point out, we're going to go through this again next year.
Yeah, I mean, this is not the
end. This is a two-year thing. Yeah. They did accelerate it, and they did pay extra to try to do this. Now, what this does, however, it doesn't fix the bridge. Okay, it just catches it
up. No, it's just maintenance work.
It's maintenance work they've been delaying for almost 10 years because they think they're going to get money for the new bridge. Well, that isn't coming. So they finally invested in just repairing it. So they repaired all the joints, they improved the lighting, they've redecked it, they put new concrete on the top, on the roadways. They're going to do more work next year. So this is a two-year project. But this doesn't fix the problems with the bridge that everybody's trying to replace in the first place.
Yeah, if we ever fix the problems with that bridge, it'll be what, 4 decades from now?
That's a political question that we can't get into right now.
Okay. Well, Amanda, thank you very much for joining us today. Amanda Seitz with WCPO.com. And coming up, we'll talk about FC Cincinnati's remarkable journey in the U.S. Open Cup. It came to an end. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, along with Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher, and WVXU's Tana Weingartner joins us now. Tana, a 3-2 loss to a team named after an energy drink. How can you?
Not just named after, sponsored by.
Yeah, sponsored by an energy drink. Right, but that was the end of a very remarkable run for FC Cincinnati.
That was a heartbreaker for FC Cincinnati fans and for the players, frankly. Laying on the field, some in tears after the game, just completely worn out after their rather remarkable Open Cup run. You know, now the Red Bulls didn't have to play as many Open Cup games as FC Cincinnati did. They had to beat 6 teams to get to where they were. The Red Bulls don't have to, you know, major league sides don't have to start playing Open Cup matches until like the 3rd or 4th round.
Yeah, how's that Open Cup work? That's just across all the different leagues? Is that how it works?
Yeah, it's an open tournament. It's a unique sort of structure. You don't see a whole lot of things like that. Anybody, any team can kind of be in it. Now some really lower level teams have to play in tournaments to get into that tournament itself. But yeah, it is sort of this interesting thing that you don't really see in any other sport.
Well, the other thing that I saw in terms of, you know, one of the reasons why they were up 2-0 or 2-0, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there you go.
They wound up giving up 3 goals in the second half, and they were completely dominated in the second half. One thing I did see, though, is that these guys, the MLS players, play every single day, and they're in incredible shape, and they have a lot more depth than a USL team. And that was one of the things that they just wore them down.
Well, and Tana mentioned how they were on the field exhausted at the end of the game.
Right.
That was my brother-in-law's observation. He was watching the game with me. He says, they look like they just ran out of steam.
Right, and they're playing a whole lot more. So imagine if you have the Bengals and you decided, you know, they play once a week, and that's, you know, about all that a football player's body supposedly can take besides your practices. So put practices on top of that. And then imagine you just decided to play an entire second game of football every week. On top of that, so maybe you had your Monday game and you had your Thursday game, or however they work it out when they do that, and then just throw another game in there on top of that, and your body is just, you know, it takes a licking when you do that.
You
and
play soccer, now, it's a hard game, isn't it?
And now FC is actually struggling, and maybe Tana can talk about this a little bit more in terms of the motion they put into either side, but they're struggling to make the playoffs in their own league.
Right, and so they're in playoff position now, but
they're
sitting in 7.
They're sitting in their division.
So did they spend a lot more energy on the cup than their league? I don't know. And I know that part of their issue was that one of their best players, Digby, was suspended for several games because of what happened in Louisville, but you know, I don't know how that all played into it.
But still sitting atop the scoring stands for the Open Cup tournament.
It is sort of different.
You know, normally, like, we're seeing record crowds for Open Cup matches all of a sudden. This is a tournament, you know, not to down soccer or anything, but this is a tournament that most fans would be like, oh, we have an Open Cup match tonight? Oh,
how many people attended the game the other night?
You know, 33,000
people. 33,000
people. It's the number two, the second most attended USL game in, you know, in their sort of modern history.
Well, this
actually in their whole 104 years.
You know, taking it off the pitch, if you will, too. But this obviously raises the next question and the bigger question about can Cincinnati or FC Cincinnati then make the jump to MSL?
MLS.
I'm sorry. Yeah. To be a major league soccer team. And I don't know, Tana, what do you think?
Well, I said for many years that I didn't think the city could sustain it. Didn't think with having Columbus right up the road. I would have said no. I'm kind of starting to lean the other way now. But you know,
I think
that
the fan
stadium,
base is there.
The fan base is there, definitely, and they're learning.
And the enthusiasm is there.
The problem is the stadium deal. And, you know, people can sit there as much as they like and say how nice Nippert is and how well it works. It's not going to be sustainable. MLS, you know, that's one of the requirements is you have to have a soccer-specific stadium. It's not necessarily in the best part of town for where MLS wants it. And, you know, it's not set up. You go to – if you want to go to the bathroom there, you know, if you're at a football game, you go to the bathroom whenever there's a break or at the quarter. If you're going to a soccer game, everyone goes to the bathroom at the same time. There's not the infrastructure at Nippert Stadium to hold, you know, to handle that.
Well, plus, isn't the MLS requirement is it has to be at least a 25,000 seat stadium? Is that is that right?
I think that is. And if you look at some of the other cities that have tried to do this, they're really struggling. Orlando and Miami, for example. Miami's getting better crowds, but Orlando has struggled. And they put it in a bad part of town, and they've already built their stadium, but it's on the public dime. And as we know, and Tana has already reported, and we've already reported, there is no interest from the political leadership of Hamilton County to put any public money into another stadium, period. Right. So where do you go? So now all of a sudden the FC leadership is talking about putting it in Newport. Well, are Cincinnati fans going to be willing to make the trek down to Newport? Even though it's a Cincinnati team. So that's a thing. And then there's this whole question of, okay, the team has to pony up $150 million to get it to even if they are accepted, if their bid is accepted as an entry fee into the league. Now there's been published reports that this money will then go to the existing teams. This has been called by experts a Ponzi scheme. So, you know, so they're paying back the investments that the original teams make that don't make money because the TV contract is terrible. They don't make any money. They can't get on national television very easily. And now all of a sudden the teams that are coming in are basically paying off the debts of the teams that have been there.
So you're dubious, I take it, then that they're going to get into the MLS.
I'm not dubious. I'm dubious of what we're getting into, you know. And then what happens, basically, the whole player structure in the league is so much different than what we're used to watching baseball or football. The league controls the players and assigns them to teams. The teams don't own the players. So it's an entirely different thing. What's the fan experience going to be? Prices go up? Who knows? Same kind of concessions? Who knows? Parking? Who knows? I mean, I know Nippert is a great experience. It's cozy and whatever, but will that translate to another stadium?
But for now, Tana, we
MLS can... doesn't control where the players go. They do have a hand in that.
Right.
And certainly in your designated players. You're like big name ones or whatever. But the teams, just to clarify, the teams do have their own buying and trading and all of that going on.
But they're paid by MLS and MLS, you know, has these different buckets from what I understand.
But Tana, I have to bring us back to the moment. They've still been on a great run, and they still have a shot at the playoffs in the USL. So they've still got a lot of good left for this season.
Yeah, their season goes through, I think, the middle of October or so, and then the postseason starts. So they're still in the run. Doesn't help getting shellacked 5-0 by Louisville going in last weekend. Well, but
who's their next opponent, by the way?
So they take on, interestingly enough, the Red Bulls have a second division side, a USL side, and that is who they're going to play on Saturday in New Jersey.
Red Bulls 2, I think, is the team. Okay.
Right. Are they playing in New York? Or is
New Jersey, I think.
James and Tana, thank you so much for joining
us
this
afternoon.
Thank you.
Enquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher, WVXU digital editor and reporter Tana Weingartner. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Rick Andres was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney.